At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
I'm John Batchelor with Professor Eric Klein. The new book is After 1177 BC. Civilization collapsed. The globalization trade collapsed. But there were big winners, called technically anti-fragile. Guess. One came with the alphabet, maybe. The other came with iron, maybe. The Phoenicians, who the professor tells me never called themselves Phoenicians. They identified with cities, Tyre and Sidon and Beirut, Byblos. Those traders, and then there are the genius metallurgists of Cyprus. And this is important to mention because we're talking about how you deal with collapse. The Assyrians dealt with it with leadership. The Egyptians dealt with it by retracting. You know, they took a recession. The Phoenicians and the Cypriots are opportunists. Accidentally, professor, or were they geniuses?
I'm going to go with genius rather than accidental. It seemed very deliberate. But yes, both the Phoenicians and the Cypriots are at the top of my list. They're the top-ranked people in terms of how you deal with a collapse, how you deal with catastrophe when your society and or your globalized network go down. What do you do when there are supply chain issues and so on? The Phoenicians and the Cypriots, as you mentioned, are what I call anti-fragile, which is a term that I've borrowed from Nassim Nicholas Taleb, who has a book of that title. And he defines anti-fragile as when you flourish in conditions of chaos, which is perfect for what happened after the collapse. Basically, the Phoenicians, who are in what is today modern-day Lebanon, they are the surviving Canaanites in central Canaan. No evidence that they really ever went down. They simply pick up and continue, but they do transform. Same thing with the Cypriots. So what the Phoenicians do, one of their secrets is that they're right there on the Mediterranean, and they take over from Ugarit when Ugarit is destroyed. And so as one of my colleagues has called it, the Mediterranean becomes a Phoenician lake, and they sail out founding colonies, including Carthage, which will eventually become a power great enough to challenge Rome in the Punic Wars centuries later. But the Phoenicians are bringing two things. They're bringing purple dye, for which they're justifiably famous, but they have also standardized the alphabet, and they spread the alphabet everywhere they go, which becomes what we now know as the Greek alphabet on the one hand, and the Latin alphabet on the other. And of course, we use the Latin alphabet today still to write English and French and German and Italian and Spanish. So that's the Phoenicians. And you're right, they never called themselves Phoenicians. That's what the later Greeks, like Herodotus, called them. They would have said, I'm from Tyre, I'm from Sidon, I'm from Beirut. The Cypriots, on the other hand, who, as we mentioned, were the ones that were providing all the copper in the late Bronze Age, they make a turn, and they seem to be the first ones to start working with iron. And they not only send iron weapons and tools around the Mediterranean, they also send the techniques and the technology. And we frequently find both Phoenician and Cypriot artifacts at the same sites at the same time during this period, which is now called the Early Iron Age for exactly that reason, that they've turned from bronze to iron.
The question about the iron, you introduced the question, so I'll ask it aloud. Was the iron of necessity because the supply chain was broken, or was it genius?
Good question, to which I have no answer. I'm going to lean towards genius, but it used to be thought that the trade routes were cut and that they were unable to get tin. And tin at that time, of course, was equivalent to our need for petroleum or more recently our name for, you know, rare earths like lithium to make the chips that run our cars and our computers. And if the trade routes from Central Asia were cut and you couldn't get tin anymore, then you couldn't make bronze, and then you're up the creek. And that is why they changed to iron out of necessity. More recently, it's been suggested that there might not have been as much of a shortage of tin as had been previously supposed, but that they changed anyway. This period is a time of innovation and invention, and I do think we need to give credit, as others have, to the Cypriots for making the transition. They don't give up bronze, but iron becomes the metal that they're using. So it turns out that once you're able to figure out how to smelt iron, because it's a very different process than making bronze, but once you can make iron, it's better for weapons and for tools and everything else. The one thing that I am at pains to say in the sequel, and I'll repeat here just very quickly, there are lots of people on the internet that say, the Sea Peoples, they took over and everything because they had iron weapons. And the answer to that is no. Iron weapons and tools do not come into use until after the collapse. They are not a reason for the collapse. So we see the transition in the later 12th century into the 11th century and all that. But once they do transition, it's better for all concerned because all of the countries have iron ore. It's readily available. You're not dependent on somebody else.
Bronze, Patroclus's armor, pretending to be Achilles, was bronze. Iron, yes, is after Homer, and we're going to come back to that because the professor introduces us to the possible origin of Homer's heroes. But at this moment, Professor, I just want to make a note here before we leave the Phoenicians. There's been a dive by Bob Ballard, who found the Titanic, but his dive to a ship that was headed to Carthage, is that the way to read this, that they were trading with Carthage this early?
Well, the Phoenicians have founded Carthage. It's one of their colonies. So they're sending ships back out because one of the reasons for the Phoenician colonies and for the Greek colonies that will come along fairly soon after this period is the colony is supposed to send raw materials back to the mother city, and the mother city sends finished goods to the colony. So these two ships, in fact, that Bob Ballard excavated along with Larry Steger of Harvard, these are two ships that were being sent between the Phoenician cities and their colony, Carthage. And they were fascinating ships. They were not quite as famous as Ulubarun, but just as important for this later period.
The reason I wanted to make a deal of that is that means Carthage is older than Rome.
Yes, you could say so. There are debates as to when Carthage was actually founded. It's certainly founded by the 8th century BC for sure. But that, in fact, is about the time that Rome seems to be starting. I mean, you've got the traditional date of, I think it's 753 BC with Romulus and Remus. And certainly there are early villages on the Palatine in the area of Rome that are from the 8th century. So I would say they're almost kind of neck and neck. Yes, Phoenicia and Carthage might be a little bit earlier, but we're all in the same ballpark here.
The book is After 1177 BC, The Survival of Civilization. We've had different models now. The Assyrians' leadership, the Egyptians' recession, take a recession. The Phoenicians and the Cypriots' genius. We're now going to move to a bump in the road, the Hittites. What happens to the people who command Anatolia and what is modern Turkey? Eric Klein.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Hey, guys. Finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy. Thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.